Thank you. It's, of course, a pleasure to be here. And this is our exciting weeks for us. Because a calculation we've been working on for a really, really long time is coming to a close. Yeah, we now have the 5-loop n equals 8 supergravity integrand, and we're still testing it, but we're confident enough that we're starting to go to the vacuum expansion, and we're starting to integrate it. And the reason we care about, well, there are many reasons we care about this. One that probably speaks to many in the room is because it's going to give us some really interesting data on the UV properties of the maximally supersymmetric supergravity theory. There's another reason it's really interesting to have this data is because it was so hard to get, and there were things that were getting in the way of making this calculation. I think we have a lot to learn from this. For more details, see the last talk of the conference on Friday. Hopefully there'll be a lot more to report, and this is going to be Zvi's talk, generalized double copies in the 5-loop integrand. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about 5 loops in this talk. What I'm going to be talking about is stories. And I often don't talk about stories, often, especially when I'm talking to you guys, when I'm talking about scattering amplitudes, I'm talking about invariant predictions. And whatever story you come up with, whatever, you know, nonlinear field redefinitions, your action or gauge choice, it doesn't matter, you're just landing on predictions. But today I'm going to talk a little bit about stories. And so I'm going to define the quantum story from actions as what you get when you just use Feynman rules, when somebody gives you an action and you use Feynman rules, and it tells you a story. It tells you a story in terms of certain players, the fields, and what they do in terms of the diagrams. And at the end, if you've done everything correctly, which can be somewhat laborious with Feynman rules, then you have an invariant prediction. But you've got a story associated with it. Different choices in how you'd write your action or what gauges you'd use would land you on different stories. The reason we don't actually often, well, so why don't we typically use Feynman rules? And the reason is very simple, because it's a big mess. Whenever we do. And in fact, for the type of calculations we're interested in, it would be impossible. Or at least it would have been impossible when we started playing this game. I think there have been a lot of advances recently that have shown that behind this is incredibly simple structure. They're actually very nice, or at least much nicer Feynman rules to talk about something like gravity with. But where we start from, if we were to use Feynman rules for a graviton to talk about a 3-loop quantum correction, we'd have about 10 to the 20 terms, 4-loop about 10 to the 26, and 5-loop 10 to the 31 terms. And so this is obviously the wrong way to go, but the final expressions are tractable. The vast majority of terms are unphysical freedom that must cancel in our predictions. In fact, for the maximally supersymmetric supergravity theory, when just looking at this one graph, you add all the other states that are running around these loops, and you get an expression that you can fit on a blackboard. In fact, with a modern approach to 3-loop calculations, you can, in fact, do 3 loops on a blackboard, as Henrik did the last time we were all at KATP in an hour. So there's a lot to be said for straying from the stories and just landing on the predictions. some secrets obscured by the actions is that when you calculate with physical on-shell quantities, your life is just much easier. Physical on-shell tree amplitudes contain all the information necessary to build all loop-level amplitudes. This is the heart of the unitarity method. Physical on-shell 3 vertices contain all the information necessary to build all tree-level amplitudes for many of the theories we're talking about. And then for effective theories, you may supplement with additional information like soft limits. But in general, you only need a small bit of information to talk about even all multiplicity tree level. And combining these two ideas, it's actually very easy to verify whether you land you're landing on the correct expression integrand. And this type of easy verification leads to a natural method of construction. This is a method of maximal cuts. So armed with these tools, with these ideas, you know, we go forth and we start calculating. And sometimes we're calculating because we're desperately interested in knowing the prediction, like the UV property of maximally supersymmetric supergravity theories. Other times we're calculating because we believe that there's structure, the structure to be uncovered in these predictions, structure that may point to different types of stories we might actually be telling. And so just to drive this point home, it's something that everybody in a scattering amplitudes conference is be well familiar with. We're talking about the S matrix that's just mapping free states to free states, and all the interactions happen in here. But what we get to do, of course, is treat this as a black box, right? We feed in some invariant information about the theory, whether it's from quantum field theory, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, string theory, even classical physics. And that constrains, that lets us know we're talking about the theory we want to talk about. But once we have that data, we're free to rearrange it however we like. And we do so in order to maximize all sorts of different things. But so what I'm going to talk about is what, well, so let me introduce the type of how we do this rearrangement. And so the idea is it's the same predictions, but definitely different stories come out. Okay, so what's a necessary condition? If I hand you some five-loop nonplanar integrand, how do you know that it's what you would have gotten if you used your favorite action in your favorite gauge? Well, what's absolutely necessary is that when you integrate whatever expression I give you, it gives the same answer as when you integrated whatever you would have generated from your Feynman rules, no matter how painful and horrible that might have been. Now, I can give you an expression in terms of graphs, as I'm wont to do, and this can make your life easier, but still, at the end of the day, you need to integrate your expression and land on the same data you would have had if you'd used Feynman rules to generate the story. So now, whatever I give you here is going to be a very different type of story. It'll involve a lot less graphs than whatever is going on here, and it's not going to necessarily tag all the particle states. In fact, I'm only going to care about organizing in terms of how information propagates and at times algebraic relations. So I won't have different diagrams for each of the 256 states running around my supergravity theory, for example. Okay, so what's a sufficient condition? Sufficient condition is now something I can talk about at the integrand, is that whatever expression I give you satisfies all the unitarity cuts. And by which I mean it matches the Feynman rules for all unitarity cuts. Now, what's different about sufficient rather than necessary? So what's changed is I got rid of an integral. In fact, this is a stronger condition than I strictly need. What I strictly need is that I match all the unitarity cuts up to things that are total derivatives, up to things that vanish upon integration, right? But we're going to impose something even stricter, which is that for on-shell, for physical quantity, gauge-invariant quantities, like unitarity cuts, that we actually have exactly the same information in our integrand cut by cut. So what do I mean by a cut as far as the Feynman rules? I mean taking a graph with blobs, expanding the blobs out as trees, and summing over the states. Summing over on-shell states. And so these are on-shell gauge invariant expressions because they're on-shell physical predictions, tree-level predictions, right? And so this would be a four-particle cut, so I'm sewing two six-particle trees together. They share the same states, and they're on-shell, right? And I sum over all the internal states that are associated with my theory. From my graphical expression, I do a similar thing. I take all the graphs that contribute to the cut, and then I expand out the graphs in terms of all graphs that can contribute to a given tree amplitude. So if I have a theory that I can write in terms of only cubic graphs, and I'm considering this cut where I've got all cubic vertices except for one four tree sown with a bunch of three trees, then I just expand this four tree in each of its S, T, and U channels, and then I take the contribution of my integrand to associated with these graphs to this cut evaluated on the on-shell momentum. Now, the nice thing about this approach is that cut span. So any tree that you can further cut, the satisfaction of a cut involving that tree means that all of its cuts are automatically satisfied. This leads to a notion of cuts spanning other cuts. If I satisfy this guy, then I've automatically satisfied all its constituents. This leads to the notion of a minimal spanning set. This gives you an easy verification. If you've got an integrand, you don't need to check every single cut in every single channel. You need to check some minimal spanning set that guarantees that all your data is there, that you've matched the data to the theory. How you've organized this information, though, doesn't have to have anything to do with the stories of your original Feynman rules. It doesn't have to have anything to do necessarily with the field content. In fact, for many of the representations that we love, it's absolutely unknown what type of action would actually generate the representation. We just know that it is the right prediction because we match all the physical data on the cuts. Okay, as I said, when you have an easy verification, there's a sort of natural way of constructing things. This should be familiar to any Americans who've ever played 20 questions. It turns out that by checking simple things with yes and no, it's very easy to actually have a game where you just ask somebody yes or no questions, and then after 20 or so, you know exactly what object they're talking about. It's because we tend not to be great at keeping more than 2 to the 20 objects in our heads, and so. But there's a very similar process associated with construction, which is, you can first ask the questions assuming certain properties. You can ask questions about local invariants that must be associated with various topologies of stuff running around. Momentum and color. So you can consider cuts down to cubic graphs, right? And they target individual cubic diagrams. No other cubic diagram can contribute to a cut that only involves three trees. Because of this, if there's ever data associated with this cut, you can associate it unambiguously with this cubic graph. After you've done this for all potential cubic graphs that can contribute, all potential cubic cuts or maximal cuts that could contribute to the prediction you're interested in, you can start releasing cut conditions and seeing what missing data is around. You can either go back and assign it to the parents, or you can allow these to exist as contact graphs in their own right that carry the information of the missing data. And you continue releasing cut conditions until you've spanned all the data that could possibly contribute. And so it's lots of little tiny calculations, but these are little tiny calculations involving physical quantities. At the end of the day, you know you have all the information, some final answer without any cut conditions, something that's entirely off-shell. But as I said before, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the story you originally told. And just to make it very clear, this is the original solution to our three-loop, four-point, maximally supersymmetric gauge theory and maximally supersymmetric gravity theory on the same page. And you'll notice that there are only 9 graphs here, right? And this guy has 16 states running around. This guy has 256 states coming around. These are by no means Feynman graphs, right? This isn't a Feynman graph story. This data has been collapsed and aggregated, right? And this was collapsed and aggregated according to this unitarity method I just described. And the way we were able to go from the gauge theory to the gravity theory is we had a way of talking. So what Quayle and Tai taught us in the 80s is that at least at tree level, there are mappings between invariants in gauge theories and invariance in gravity theories. So color-stripped amplitudes in gauge theories map to color-stripped amplitudes in supergravity theories. And this is a story-independent statement, right? It's just in terms of tree-level amplitudes. And of course, this generalizes to cuts involving tree-level amplitudes. So once we had this guy, right, once we had this guy entirely off-shell, then by cutting this guy in a very compact way, we had all the data associated with this guy. We were able to build him. Now, you'll see is that there's some structure that emerged out of our construction that all of these guys, the kinematic weight associated with the gauge theory, the full weight associated with the graph was the square of it for all of these guys. And the same with all of these guys. Now, Now, all right, these guys and all these guys. Now, these guys, there's no such story, right? You can see that there's some echo of structure relating stuff, but there's all this other stuff hanging around. It turns out there is a way. There is a story you can come up with, at least the level of scattering amplitudes, where you can line up the stories between your gauge theory and the gravity theory so that they're directly related, so that the kinematic weight associated with your gauge theory is the square root, or is one of the factors of the weights in your supergravity predictions. But this is very much a rearrangement of the data of what I showed you on the previous slide. And we don't know of any nonlinear field redefinition of maximally supersymmetric supergravity theory, such that if you jumped up and down on your Feynman rules and you're powerful enough to take it out to your, 10 to the 20 terms per graph, that everything would collapse into this without shaking, right? We don't have that story. But what we do have is we have an algorithmic story at the level of the scattering amplitudes that lets us rearrange the data into a form that obeys that makes this structure manifest. And we're starting to learn more and more about how to arrive at these stories at the level of the action. Okay, and so now, since I'm the first speaker talking about color kinematics and double copy, let me just review this for those of you who aren't intimately familiar with it. Okay, and so the story is that color and kinematics dance together, that you can arrange your gauge theory amplitudes and additional theories, gauge theory amplitudes though, for right now, such that your kinematic weights associated with graphs obey the same algebraic relations as the color weights associated with graphs. And this is a surprising thing, but when you do, you've rearranged your data in your gauge theory such that you can strip off the color weights and replace it with something else that obeys the same algebraic relations. If you do another copy of Yang-Mills, you'll land on gravity theory. If you replace it with the kinematic weights of the nonlinear sigma model, you'll land on supersymmetric Dirac, Born-Infeld with Volkov-Okulov. There are all sorts of theories, a whole web of theories that this is relevant to. But the point is, once you arrange your story such that your kinematics is playing the same game as your color factors, then you can start prying apart theories and putting them together like Legos or Tinker Toys. very specifically, let me just be very concrete. So to all multiplicity at tree level, we know that you can organize your gauge theory scattering amplitudes in terms of cubic graphs. That's already a rearrangement from the standard action, which will involve contact terms, right? So, but it turns out you can always assign those contact terms to cubic graphs, so you can arrange it in terms of cubic graphs, but not only can you do that, but you can do it in such a way that your kinematic weights always obey anti-symmetry as well as Jacobi for each edge, which is a property of these color weights. Since these color weights are just sitting around obeying Jacobi and anti-symmetry, you can replace the color weights with another copy of the kinematic weights and land on invariant predictions for your supergravity theory. But notice, this isn't of the form of Kuai-Leong-Tai, which is something in terms of invariance, right? Something in terms of color-ordered scattering amplitudes mapping to invariance. This is a local story, graph by graph, where you can line up your gauge theory predictions and your gravity theory predictions. Okay, so if you look closely at Albert and you see a twinkle in his eye, you might see Yang and Mills staring back at you. But since this is an off-shell story, right, this is a story that's local, it's not a physical story, it's an off-shell story, there's a natural generalization to loop level, which is so at loop level, we're going to have a symmetry factor because we want something that's automorphic invariant so that every way that you could possibly map your expression to your graph is symmetric. After modding out by that symmetry factor, again, it's the same thing. The idea is that you can find a representation where your kinematics obey the same rules as your algebra. Now, what I've talked about mostly, what I'm going to continue to talk about mostly, are Yang-Mills, where we're just in the adjoint, but this applies to all sorts of theories, which involve the fundamental, and for spontaneous symmetry breaking, you get additional identities, additional relations between graphs, and to put the kinematics in a colored dual form, you have to you follow the nose of obeying the algebra. Once you obey the algebra, then you can double copy. All right. So scattering amplitudes of many relativistic theories admit a double copy numerator algebra. Right, so you've got two copies intertwined. This points to a previously hidden structure in many theories, structure yet to be generally understood at the level of the action. But more and more, especially recently, we're getting deeper insights into ways of telling the story at the level of the action. So let me just give a sample of some of the theories this is relevant to. This is relevant to one of the most phenomenological theories, nonlinear symmetry called the Cairo-Lagrangian. It's relevant to, so this picture up here, I don't know if scattering amplitudes people particularly care about this, but nilpotent superfields are incredibly useful verb to have in your language of telling stories having to deal with inflation or dark energy. Well, it turns out nilpotent superfields are one-to-one with Volkov-Okulov, which is a double copy, QCD with actual massive fundamental fermions, quarks, you could obeys color kinematics. And it turns out even string theory at tree level, open and closed strings, you can understand as field theory double copies of things that behave like field theories. So here I list many of the theories by adjoint scalar, Yang-Mills through QCD and supersymmetric variants thereof, supergravity, supersymmetric Einstein-Yang-Mills, where you actually have gauge theory interacting with your gravity theory can be understood as double copies. The Cairo-Lagrangian, superstructural coordinate field, Galilean. And I'll talk a little bit more about Z theory a little later. Now, to give you some of the nouns and verbs of the story being told at the level of the action, I'm going to introduce a geometric picture, which involves polytopes. You don't need to think about the geometric picture at all. If you're comfortable staring at matrix identities, you can stare at matrix identities all you want. But I like this geometric picture, and so I'm going to talk about it. So there's a convenient language to talk about these predictions, which is a graph of graphs. So at 4-point, you've got three cubic graphs, and they're related by Whitehead moves. Or I'll call them Jacobi moves, which take every edge to just various configurations of the legs leading into it. So a U-hat move will take an S-channel to a U-channel. You'll see it's got the same external guys, but they're just meeting in different ways. And a T-hat move will take the S-channel to the T-channel. You'll notice, for those of you who care about color ordering, that T-channel, see, orange, blue, like red, blue, orange, green, red, blue, orange, green. So T hat preserves color ordering, whereas U hat twists it all up. Okay, but Jacobi identities are manifest in general as triangles in the graph of graphs. And color kinematics means that these guys are all related. If you know two of these guys, then you know a third. graphs contributing to a color stripped tree amplitude or color ordered tree amplitude to gauge invariant building blocks are generated by the one skeleton of the Stashev polytopes joined only by T hats. So you just start with something that has the color order you care about, right? You just start with one graph that has a color order you care about, and you apply T hat, the color preserving whitehead move, to all edges till closure. This will generate the one skeleton of a classic polytope called Stashev polytopes or sosihedra. And so these are all the graphs that contribute to, in this case, a 5-point color ordered partial amplitude. Now that's not the full amplitude for your gauge theory. At tree level, you've got 15 cubic graphs. You might think that you need n minus 2 factorial of these color ordered amplitudes to capture everything, 6 of these pentagons to capture everything, because that's what's needed to touch every vertex at least once. In fact, such a choice is a Kleist-Coif basis, a basis proven sufficient by Del Duca, Dixon, and Moltoni. But notice, because of color kinematics, only n minus 2 factorial nodes, I only need to specify this boundary data, and then I have Jacobi relations propagating in. So you see, for all the boundary data, I've got a triangle bringing into the inner level, and then triangles between those propagate to the innermost level. So all I need to do is specify the boundary data, right, these 6 outer nodes, and then Jacobi relations will propagate to the bulk. This reduces the set of necessary color-ordered amplitudes to n minus 3 factorial, and this is sort of a graphical way of understanding these n minus 3 factorial relations, the fact that you only need a basis of n minus 3 factorial color-ordered amplitudes to describe everything. Now, this is the invariant information you need. It turns out this is always associated with the one skeleton of a polytope, but it's a one polytope formed by using the U-hat operator till closure. And so what you do is you take the half ladder, fix 2 of the legs, and allow the internal guys to permute. So start with 1, 2, 3. The U-hat on this edge will just swap 2 and 1. The U-hat on that edge will take you back here, so you do it on the other edge, and it'll swap 3 and 1, and so on till closure. So at 5 points, it's this hexagon is the polytope. The polytope is called a permutahedra. I didn't come up with this name. This is some classical polytope. Mathematicians named it a permutahedra. You can linearly solve for these 6, these n minus 2 factorial numerators in the masters, in terms of the n minus 3 factorial independent color ordered amplitudes. And what you'll find is, of course, that you have a tremendous amount of freedom. In fact, you have more freedom as your multiplicity increases, as the number of particle scattering increases. And you can ask, what's that freedom for? And conjecturally, that freedom is what allows you to solve for color kinematics at loop level. We call this generalized gauge freedom. It's a fact that after fixing 2 of these guys to correctly reproduce these and the other guys to not interfere, then the other guys can be anything you want, and it doesn't matter. There's complete generalized gauge freedom. It will never affect any physical prediction. Okay, now let's sew in the building blocks at 6 points. The sosihedra, the guy formed by applying T hat to every edge until closure. This is what's associated with the color stripped amplitude. The set of masters is associated permutahedron. There are 105 cubic graphs at 6 point, right? But they're all specified by this boundary data. And this boundary data, the guy applying U hat everywhere, you can fix by 6 of these of these isosceles. So just to summarize the story, these gauge invariant building blocks that speak to the theory, these color ordered amplitudes, color kinematics means that you only need to specify the boundary data, and you can solve for the full amplitude efficiently in terms of the independent of these guys specifying this and allowing Jacobi to propagate to the bulk. For those that want to actually see expressions, if that was too much graphs, so the full color-dressed amplitude, color kinematics over propagator, so summing over the a color weight and a kinematic weight associated with every vertex, the color stripped gauge theory are the graphs that contribute to a fixed color order, right, with no colors, just the kinematic weights over propagators. Now, color stripped gauge theory, I'll point out, is the same thing as kinematic stripped gravity. So if I've got gravity written in a double copy and I strip off one of the kinematic orders, what I'm left with is color stripped Yang-Mills. So, I mean, we think about these as Yang-Mills color-ordered scattering amplitudes. That's a little prejudicial. We could also think of them as kinematic stripped gravity amplitudes. The same way that kinematic stripped Yang-Mills amplitudes, so if I strip off the kinematic weights, right, I'm left with color factors sitting over propagators. This is the same thing as color stripped by adjoint scalar amplitudes. All right. And as I was saying, what you can do is, given the spanning color ordered, color stripped Yang-Mills amplitudes, you could invert to solve for your kinematic weights in terms of your color ordered amplitudes, because in general, these guys aren't independent, right? They satisfy relations between them. And it's this inversion isn't unique, it's a pseudo-inversion. You have choice in how you solve for these kinematic weights in terms of your color-ordered amplitudes. And this is the generalized gauge freedom I was referring to. Now, what you can see is that, so if I write my gravity in terms of my color kinematic satisfying representation, I write my numerators in terms of their sosihedra, right, and the inverse propagators, I'm summing over the cubic graphs, and I'm summing over the different orders of my color order amplitudes. All the bits that depend on the graphs, I can pull inside, right? And this gives a relationship between gauge invariance and gauge invariance. In fact, this is a way to get all the different sort of representations of the KLT type momentum kernel or matrix that are inner products between these gauge invariants.